Welcome to Talking Walking, hosted by Andrew Stuck from Rethinking Cities and the Museum of Walking. Talking Walking brings you interviews with people from the world of walking, artists, activists, professionals, and those of us who have a passion for just taking a walk. Author and long-distance walker Stephen Ford and I are walking through woodland on the side of open fields with traffic on the A3 rushing past half a mile away. It's not the first time that Stephen and I have met to record an interview. 6 weeks ago, we had walked across Esher Common together, and much to my embarrassment, I discovered that my voice recorder's hard drive was full to capacity, so much of the interview wasn't actually recorded. Stephen forgave me for this schoolboy error, and this time proposed that we would walk on Common closer to Claygate. As you'll discover from our conversation, there's a necklace of publicly accessible common in this part of Surrey that is much frequented by dog walkers and joggers. The interview opens with Stephen telling us about where it is we're walking.
We are in Claygate and we're just walking over towards Arbrook Woods, which is just next door to Esher Common and Oxshott Heath and lots of other nice places to walk.
And this is really just a modest stroll for a man like yourself.
Yes. although I have to be a bit more modest these days because earlier in the year I fell off a ladder and broke my foot, so I'm not quite as mobile as I used to be.
But you've just told me that 10 miles is no problem, 20 is... have to have a bit of willpower, but in the past you didn't think much that you could shrug off 30
yes,
in a
correct.
Day.
That's correct, yes.
And we're talking miles.
We're talking miles, that's right, yes.
So what's been your drive to want to walk far and fast?
I think it's just getting a bit of air in your lungs out in the countryside, time to think. When you're with somebody else you can have a chat. But it's equally nice on your own. So,
And were you prompted to do it by a sort of health scare, or is it something you've done for a long time?
I've always liked to walk around, actually. Even as far back as I can remember, I always, like, if I wanted to just sort of clear my head, even as a teenager, I'd sort of just go out for a wander somewhere.
Now, because are you chair or secretary to the Surrey? Is it
Surrey Long Distance Walkers Association? Well, I'm currently walk secretary, but they're twisting my arm and suggesting I should be chair next year, so...
You've broken your foot, now they're twisting your arm.
Yes.
So tell us a little bit about the Long Distance Walking Association, should we have any listeners who haven't come across them before.
The Long Distance Walkers Association is best described probably as ramblers on steroids. It's similar to ramblers, but we don't get out of bed for less than about 20 miles, whereas ramblers are much more modest than that, and tend to walk quite briskly and quickly, and the people involved have done crazy feats like walking from Land's End to John O'Groats and breaking records and walking the length of New Zealand and those kind of things.
Does that include you?
Not me, no, I've not done any feat like that, but we're the sort of people who would aspire to do those sorts of things and have done those things.
And you walk regularly as a group or twice a week or just a...
We're organised roughly into counties. Surrey is the one I'm in, but next to us we've got Thames Valley, we've got Wessex, which is Hampshire, Dorset, Sussex, Kent and so on, and London. So all of those have their own group. But we can walk with each other's group, so I've quite often walked with a lot of those neighbouring groups. When they've got a walk that I quite fancy.
Do you take it in turns to devise a route?
We have what we call challenge walks, and those are sort of regular events that happen typically annually. We've got about four of those which we run as Surrey, and those are sort of semi-competitive. In practice, people like to sort of see where they are on the league table of speed around the route and dress up in lycra and whiz around at great speed. And those range in distance from about 20 miles up to 100 miles.
Good God.
We do one 100-mile events every year.
What's the process for getting involved?
So the website, so look up Long Distance Walkers Association, LDWA, and you'll find it. And you can really just turn up. You know, you'll see social walks advertised. So find one that's, you know, you fancy going on, that's fairly local.
And, you know, is it sort of annual sub or you pay per walk? Or?
No, it's an annual sub. Pretty cheap, like £10 or something. It's not,
yeah,
not going to break the bank. If you do become a member, of course, then you get a discount on all the challenge events. So a lot of people join just so that they can get a, do the challenge events more cheaply.
Now, what are we listening to in the background? Is that the M25 or the A3?
That's the A3, the traffic roar. Sorry, I hope it's not coming A3 on the recording.
Well, it will do, but as long as we tell the listener, now that they know. But that's good because that helps put it on the map, you know. So there's you're never far away from a motorway, but we're in an interesting piece of woodland, and you say this stretches quite a distance.
Yes, you could from here. We're in Arbrook Common at the moment. If you go on from here, you get onto Esher Common, which is quite extensive. That joins onto, on one side, West End Common, Oxshott Heath, and then from Oxshott Heath you can get onto Ashstead Common and Epsom Common.
It's quite extensive. Yeah, brilliant. We're just on that sort of margin where I can imagine there'll be the pylons are here, and yet we're in Surrey countryside, are we not?
Yes.
And Surrey's a great county because there are sort of patches of rurality, aren't there? And up on the hills, you can be twisty little lanes.
Yeah, a lot of twisty little lanes. It's quite difficult to navigate in a vehicle. Surrey, I believe, is one of the most wooded counties in the country, certainly in England. And apparently the reason is that the farming land is rubbish. So historically, a lot of it wasn't farmed because it wasn't very good farming. So trees grew. So we're very fortunate, got a lot of trees, a lot of nice hills, nice walking country. But we're just on the edge of London.
Well, anyway, we've arranged this interview. It's not just to talk about your interest and enthusiasms of walking faster than far. It's actually to talk about your writing. And that's something you've only recently taken up.
Yes, I took it up after I retired from a career in IT. The thing that sort of got me into it was all the crazy things that are happening in the world. And rather than just sort of moaning about it and being frustrated and so on, I thought, I just write about it.
Do you find that the writing process helps you resolve things in your mind?
Yes, it does, yes. What it does is, once I've written about it, thought it through, made a story about it, then I feel, right, that's done. I've got that off my chest now. I don't have to worry too much about that because I've gone through the process of figuring out what I think about it.
In my opinion, you'd rather approach the writing not dissimilar to your walking because you're fast and furious. How long have you been writing and how many books have you now written?
Okay, well, I got my first one published last year, which was Destiny of a Free Spirit. Although I had been attempting to write maybe for 3-4 years before that, and it just took me that long to sort of get one published. Since then, this year, I've had two more published, and I've got two more in the pipeline due out next year, so that will bring me up to 5 novels by probably about the middle of next year.
I mean, that is incredible. Yeah, how long are these novels?
They're a range from about, I would say, 70,000 words up to about 90,000, sort of just or just under 300 pages probably.
Weaving that kind of narrative and keeping the reader's attention for that length of time, that takes quite a skill. So how have you honed that? Where's that come from?
What I've discovered from the process of writing is there's a lot of different angles writing a novel. I think the first thing is obviously you have to have a flair for words and be able to put nice phraseology together and poetic turns of phrase and that sort of thing. That's a kind of prerequisite, and you can't really be a writer unless you've got a bit of that. Of course, an awful lot more to it than that. I sort of always kind of known that I had a kind of good way with words, even just writing technical reports and manuals and things like that. So obviously I kind of knew I had that. But then I've since discovered that there's an awful lot to the construction and design of a novel, because you've got to think about what's the storyline, what characters do you need, what are the subplots, how do they interconnect, and when in the narrative do they interconnect, what features of the story there are, and when the reader is going to discover them. Because obviously you don't want to give the game away at the start, you want to sort of all come together at the end when it all becomes clear. So you've got to keep all these strands sort of separate, not resolved, to keep the reader interested and have a strategy for resolving them. So that requires a lot of thinking through.
It's interesting because the listener can't watch you, but I can tell the listener now that while Stephen's been talking, he's been moving his hands and crossing his fingers and interweaving his fingers.
Well, it has a lot in common with designing IT systems, actually. I think my time in IT wasn't wasted because I've been able to apply those same skills. It's very similar way of thinking, because in an IT system, everything has to tie together and work perfectly, otherwise the whole system falls to bits. So the idea that that attention to detail and keeping a holistic view of a lot of detail is definitely something that I've worked with.
And the genre that you're writing in, or is it not a genre?
Yeah, fantasy with a little bit of science fiction, a little bit of dystopian with the old political undertone. So it's all that.
Were you influenced by other authors that you've read?
My heroes in some of these things are people like George Orwell, H.G. Wells, and I suppose also C.S. Lewis and Narnia and some of those sort of fantasy.
And you're writing
things
for an adult audience, not
for an adult audience, not for children.
Yeah. No, fantastic. So are the characters long distance walkers?
There is just one of my books, which is Walking Out of This World, which is my second book, which is very much featuring long distance walkers. And I've called the organisation the Far and Fast Walkers Association, so as not to be sued by the LDWA. And I'm writing about one of my main characters is the local walk secretary for the Surrey group. So it's sort of a little bit autobiographical in that sense.
Say again the title.
Walking Out of This World.
Walking Out of This World was the one that your publicist Ben contacted me about. So,
yes.
So do you want to just give the listener a chance to don't give away too much?
It's a book about spirits and the supernatural. The basic plot is that doing a regular walk in the autumn, in the pouring rain, in the somewhere in the Surrey Hills, a new member turns up, a new person turns up for the walk who we haven't seen before. And he's a slightly mysterious character. He seems to know things about people that are strange, because you don't understand how he would know those things. And then at lunchtime, it's pouring down with rain in a clearing in the woods. Everyone's getting absolutely soaked and soggy sandwiches and the rest of it. And he suggests that why don't we go to this local pub that I know? I know the landlord, it'd be wonderful. He's usurping the walk's leader authority. And the walk leader says, well, there's no village anywhere near here. It can't possibly be a pub. I know the route, you know, what are you talking about? But he does persuade the other walkers that it would be nice and cosy to go to this place. Leads the group to this village, and it's not on any map. It's a strange place, and it's set back in time, like a throwback.
Well, let's go there. Let's stop it there and leave it for the reader to the listener to become a reader.
Indeed.
Okay, so you've got two more you've already written to come.
I've got two more in the pipeline. There's a third one that's also already published just this last September.
Are these going to be kind of sequential? Are they going to be like sequels? Or
they're all pretty much different, actually. Each one has its own theme.
You're sorting out the world at the moment.
In different ways, yes. So my next one was the Glastonbury Triangle, which, I went overboard with that fantasy on that one. I've got a mad scientist who's going to convert people into mythical Greek beasts like centaurs and satyrs and mermaids and that sort of thing. And people are disappearing. So the main character is a reporter who's trying to track down why all these people have disappeared. Because one of them's his girlfriend. And he has to rescue her before she gets turned by the mad scientist into a mermaid. So yes, I just didn't totally indulge myself with that one. Seems to have been quite well received, though, because I wasn't quite sure. I thought I might have gone over the top.
Do you find that an editor is really helpful?
My first three books have all been with the same publisher and the same editor. He and I have got quite a good relationship. And I've learned an awful lot from him. And, in fact, I've improved a lot by his coaching, really. My first book, Destiny of a Free Spirit, I think he sort of hacked around with every page, practically. Not in a drastic way, but put lots of fine-tuning. And he picked up my bad habits and all the rest of it, and that was all very useful. When I got to my second book, I think the amount of editing he did was probably about half of what I did in my first book, so I'd learned something. And my third book, same editor, the edits were pretty minimal, really, and it was a lot of it was about style. And I was pushing back a lot and saying, no, I want it my way. And we're having a discussion about it. A good editor is actually a godsend. Yeah, I think if you're an author starting out, you need a good editor. And I was fortunate that my first publisher, I had that.
Well, you know, we're in a topsy-turvy world, and you're trying to resolve it, Stephen, with some novels which are tackling your own anxieties and issues that are coming to the forefront of your mind. What do you think of the next United States president, Donald Trump 2.0?
I'd quite like to mention my next book.
Let's do it.
That's coming out, not published yet, but hopefully will soon, because it's quite topical with the election of Trump. Called it No Free Speech for Hate, and the subject matter is actually why I had to change publisher, because I think I might have offended my original publisher, I'll put it to them. I'm lampooning the woke left, if you like. It's about a very progressive university, which I've called Slough University, which actually turns out to be Eton College, if you read the book, repurpose as a university. I'm describing a society where everything progressive has taken over. And I think everything I put in there are things that are actually happening. So it's not that I'm making anything up. But when you put them together the way I have, it sounds bizarre. But perhaps that's what it is. And what I'm trying to put it up is a mirror to people on the left. I'm on the left myself, but put people on the left of politics and say, look how you appear to the great mass out there. It's about a conflict between the people in the university who have that progressive outlook, if you like, and outside. There's a guy called, I've called Gordon Garage, but you can guess who he is. His audience are the people who are excluded from this new society. The non-graduates, the people who don't get to higher education, the people who have to make a living in the rough, tough world. And it's particularly rough and tough now because everything has been made into a graduate profession. So you can't become a plumber without being a graduate. Not officially. But of course, there's thousands and thousands of people out there doing plumbing illegally, unlicensed, because they're a whole lot cheaper than the people who've got the posh degree. So this great mass of people out there who are living on benefits, who are struggling, feeling alienated by the new world, brings the whole thing to a head, is that the progressives want to abolish Remembrance Day. They've already abolished the monarchy, and they want to abolish Remembrance Day because it's jingoistic and militaristic and those terrible things. Great mass of the population outside the ranks don't like this and get organised by the Gordon Garage character, who then leads the revolution and takes over the government. It's a kind of echo on what's actually happened in America, with this re-election of Donald Trump. That's what my book's about. I've tried to make it amusing and lampooning some of the excesses, making people think about it. That's what I'm trying to do with that one.
You know, Stephen, if you recommend a couple of walks, just remember that some of my listeners aren't going to be as fast and furious as you are. But, seriously, what would you recommend as a couple of walks?
I think I'll start with one right in the middle of London, because it's amazing how walkable London is if you sort of know where you're going. And I think the one I would choose would be start from Paddington Basin, where the canals come together, and then walk along the canal past Camden Lock and along as far as King's Cross, because that takes you in another world, really, of narrow boats, people living on narrow boats and all tucked away, and you can't see it. Roads go straight over it, and you wouldn't even know there was a canal underneath. And you go past expensive houses around Regent's Park, including the American ambassador's residence.
You walk through the zoo as well.
And you walk through the zoo. So all sorts of little interesting little things there. And it's right there in the middle of London. So that's one. Another walk.
Maybe we should ask you, what's been the most inspiring walk that you've done? And maybe use that as the suggestion.
Okay, so in Romania, very remote in the Carpathians, on a trip where we took in the Romania's highest mountain, which isn't all that high actually, but it's right there among in Dracula country with bears and wolves and Carpathian shepherd dogs, which are the giant beasts that defend the flocks of sheep and from the bears and wolves. So they're even more ferocious than the bears and wolves. Watch for those. Well, that was a fascinating.
And did you work those out yourself, or did you go with a walking holiday company? Or
it was organised, which I think is worthwhile, because it'll never go to plan if you try and organise it yourself. Quite nice to be in a group as well, chat to people in the group and support each other.
You've been listening to Talking Walking, brought to you by Rethinking Cities and the Museum of Walking. In this episode, you've heard from Stephen Ford. If you have any views on this interview or any walking issues, we'd love to hear from you. Just follow the links on the Talking Walking website. We look forward to having you along for future episodes of Talking Walking. Written, recorded and produced by Andrew Stark of Rethinking Cities Limited, our artwork is designed by Ian Martin of Aardvark Graphics, and the music is composed by Simon Sanders of Easytronic.